Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. This week, we're reading from the March 25th, 22 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week, in the foreground is President Vladimir Putin. In the background is a now familiar scene. It looks like one of the destroyed Ukrainian cities. There's about an eight-story apartment building that's in rubble and flames. There's rubble all around Putin. He's got his hand on a chest. It's been unlocked, and it's cracked open a little bit. There are, I think, a nuclear warning sign on it and a chemical warning sign on it, and there's a eerie green glow coming through the crack where he's holding it open. The headline is Putin's blackmail. Should the risk he'll use nuclear and chemical weapons keep the West from intervening? And I believe that's part of our first main story. Russia intensifies its brutal civilian assault. What happened? Stalled in its efforts to advance on Ukraine's major cities, the Russian military this week stepped up aerial bombardments that destroyed residences, schools, government buildings, and hospitals, killed thousands of civilians, and left others without food, power, or heat. In Kyiv, the mayor imposed a 35-hour curfew amid intensified shelling that killed dozens and damaged and set ablaze numerous apartment buildings. In Kharkiv, city officials said more than 500 residents had been killed by heavy shelling that has destroyed museums, libraries, and government buildings. In northern Chernihiv, Russian troops who've circled the city are annihilating civilians, said Mayor Vladislav Astroshenko. A withering Russian assault in southern Mariupol killed an estimated 2,500 civilians, many of whom were rolled into mass graves and left dozens of buildings, including a maternity hospital, reduced to rubble and hundreds of thousands of cold, hungry people trapped in basements and shelters. The city is absolutely destroyed, said a city official. It's absolutely terrifying. Russian ground forces massed outside Kyiv and other major cities in the western half of the country have made little progress, said U.S. defense officials. They were struggling to conduct offensive operations amid sustained Ukrainian resistance, supply shortages, and extensive troop losses, said the U.K. Ministry of Defense. Russian officials were calling up reinforcements and trying to recruit mercenaries from Syria and elsewhere, and reportedly asked the Chinese government for troop rations and other supplies. Russian soldiers were reportedly looting houses and stores in search of food. Convoys were stalled due to fuel shortages and equipment failures. Peace talks resumed, and negotiations for Russian President Vladimir Putin said the discussions had shown progress on a number of positions. Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky said there was certainly room for compromise, and that Russian negotiators were becoming more realistic in their demands. Any war ends with an agreement, he said. What the columnist said. In Mariupol, a humanitarian catastrophe is underway, said Greg Jaffe and Meg Kelly in the Washington Post. It is a place of overflowing morgues, newly dug mass graves, and bodies in some cases buried under rubble or left in the streets where they fell. Citizens huddle in basements and melt snow for water. Stores have been stripped bare by starving residents, and the sound of warfare is constant. Military analysts fear it offers a sign of what's to come in Kyiv and across Ukraine as the war grinds on. Inflicting such devastation may look like strength, said David Von Drell in the Washington Post. But 3 weeks into Vladimir Putin's disastrous error, the real story is Russia's weakness. In his zeal to flex his muscles, Putin has instead revealed the extent of his nation's decline. His hapless military has made one tactical blunder after another, failing to establish air superiority, sending tank columns down open roads where they can be ambushed, and botching battlefield logistics such as providing troops with food and armored vehicles with fuel. No wonder Putin is reportedly pleading for help from China's Xi Jinping. For Russian troops, it's only going to get worse, said James Stardist, former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, in Bloomberg. Undertrained and undersupplied, they're already absorbed a stunning number of casualties, at least 4,000 and likely more. As they move into Kyiv, they'll face brutal street fighting against well-armed locals who know every corner and intersection. Still, the Russians boast mass and sheer scale, and time is on their side if they choose to simply grind down the Ukrainians and reduce the cities to rubble. Putin simply can't afford to lose, said Yasmin Serhan in The Atlantic. Michael Kaufman, a Russian military expert at the Center for Naval Analyses, says the Russian dictator is now using the same scorched-earth tactics that leveled cities in Syria and Chechnya, where arguably far less was at stake. Putin needs an off-ramp, said Tom McTague, also in The Atlantic. Western leaders are determined to make Putin pay for his barbarism, but it's even more imperative to end a war that's become a zero-sum conflict. The only way to get Putin to accept a negotiated defeat is to offer him a fig leaf that allows him to claim some measure of victory. That means the West may have to write off parts of eastern Ukraine, even if rewarding Putin for his invasion is a bitter pill to swallow. Putin doesn't want an off-ramp, said Jim Garrity in National Review. His economy may be in free fall, his military may be imploding, but the belief that the right set of incentives and concessions will get him to settle for a relatively modest prize, like the Donbas region, is deluded. He's dead set on crushing Ukraine and ousting Zelensky. And to achieve those goals, he doesn't care how much he and everyone else has to pay in blood and treasure. The controversy of the week. Don't say gay, the impact of Florida's ban. Florida's parental rights and education bill may sound reasonable on the surface, said Kara Swisher in the New York Times. But don't be fooled. The Don't Say Gay law is an attempt by Sunshine State Republicans, led by Governor Ron DeSantis, to cynically tap into fears that kids are being indoctrinated into being gay or transgender. Using vague but menacing language, the new law bans any classroom instruction about sexual orientation or gender identity in kindergarten through third grade, or in a manner that is not age-appropriate for other grades. Parents are authorized to sue any school district they believe is violating these prohibitions. One GOP lawmaker, Senator Dennis Baxley, said the law would address a real trend change in which too many young people were coming out as LGBTQ. Are we encouraging this? Baxley said. Having grown up as a gay kid in Florida, said Elliot Schreffer in USA Today, I can tell you that forbidding discussion of homosexuality won't make kids simply decide not to be gay or trans. Instead, it will return them to the tortured world I experienced, in which everyone, including me, believed being gay was unnatural and awful. Look, parents simply want a say in how their young children are introduced to controversial topics, said Joseph Murray in the Orlando Sentinel. Is that such a bad thing? As a gay educator myself, I think it's perfectly appropriate to remove the culture wars from the classroom and let parents guide the emotional development of their kids. To millions of parents, this law no doubt sounds non-controversial, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Kindergartners are supposed to be learning how to read. To their tiny ears, sexual orientation is a string of silly, nonsense syllables. and molest them or club and involving believe that their critics say students will be shamed if they mention having two moms or dads, but the bill specifically refers to instruction about sexual orientation. Elementary school curricula should focus on learning, not promoting someone's cultural agenda. The bigots behind this bill hardly have a neutral agenda, said Monica Hess in the Washington Post. DeSantis' press secretary tweeted that it should be called the anti-grooming bill, adding that if you oppose it, you are probably a groomer, or at least you don't denounce the grooming of 4 to 8 year old groomers as a pedophile. So she's saying that any teacher who discusses homosexuality or gender identity is hoping to convert, enable other people to molest them. As Fox News host Laura Ingraham put it, public schools have become essentially grooming centers for gender identity radicals. This dangerous rhetoric could subject gay and trans people to even more harassment and violence than they already experience. The Florida law is part of a much larger backlash against cultural change, said Brandon Tinsley in CNN.com. At least 15 states have proposed bills to restrict conversations about gender and sexual orientation, including Arizona, where Republicans want to require parental approval before high school students can join a sexuality, gender, or gender identity. Republicans are playing on the fears of white conservative Christians whose entire existence is in danger. To excite this base, DeSantis, who clearly has 2024 presidential aspirations, would gladly erase the hard-won equality of gay and trans people and send them back to the closet. There's one word for that: cruel. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for the union after the New Hampshire House voted 323-13 to reject a Republican legislator's proposal for the Granite State to secede from the U.S. and form its own sovereign nation. Nonetheless, said State Representative Matthew Santanastaso, national divorce is going to happen. It was a good week for the Eiffel Tower, which grew by 6 meters when a helicopter lowered a new communications antenna onto the top of the 133-year-old landmark, making it 330 meters, 1,083 feet tall. And it was a good week for New Zealand, which is reopening to tourists after 2 years of pandemic isolation. The Kiwis were hit by the Omicron wave in January, but by then had an 81% vaccination rate and have suffered just 102 COVID deaths since 2020. But it was a bad week for empty threats after Kremlin mouthpieces on Russian state TV demanded that the U.S. give back Alaska. In a tit-for-tat, Russia imposed sanctions on 11 Americans, including Hunter Biden and Hillary Clinton, but not, for some reason, Donald Trump. It was a bad week for getting back to normal after at least 9 House Democrats tested positive for COVID-19 after 5 of them attended a maskless party retreat in Philadelphia. All were vaccinated and had mild symptoms. Finally, it was a bad week for make work after a dentist in Jackson, Wisconsin, was convicted of deliberately drilling into and damaging patients' teeth so he could justify installing crowns. In a single year, Scott Charmoli raked in $2.5 million for more than 1,000 crown procedures, which his attorney has described as evidence of good business acumen. The briefing this week is titled Putin's Messianic Mission. The autocrat's Darwinian worldview was shaped by a grim childhood, the KGB, and the fall of the Berlin Wall. How did Putin grow up? Born in 1952, Putin spent his childhood in St. Petersburg, then called Leningrad, in the shadow of World War II. During the Nazis' 871-day siege of Leningrad, more than a million citizens died. Starvation drove some people to cannibalism. Putin's father was a factory worker and a devoted communist who'd reportedly worked for the NKVD, the party's feared law enforcement arm. Putin grew up in a communal apartment in a drab housing complex where he and his friends chased rats in the hallways for amusement. The short, scrawny boy was bullied, driving him to take up judo and sambo, a Soviet martial art that teaches participants to remain stoic even in the face of great pain. Wily and inscrutable, Putin earned a reputation as a ruthless street fighter, unafraid to take on far larger opponents. He learned, he later wrote, that when threatened, you must hit first and hit so hard that your opponent will not rise to his feet. When did he become a spy? Taken as a boy by depictions of brave, resourceful agents in books and movies, Putin knew at a young age he wanted to join the KGB and reportedly asked about signing up while still in high school. His attraction to the Gestapo-like agency during the height of KGB repression against the Soviet dissident movement speaks volumes, said Rutgers political scientist Alexander Model. Recruited after studying law at Leningrad State University, Putin was evaluated during his training as a risk-taker with an unusually low sense of fear, according to Putin's own account. KGB officers were trained to be predatory, inscrutable, and devoted, above all, to the Russian state. After several years in Leningrad, he was sent to Dresden, East Germany, in 1985. There he had what is often called the most pivotal experience of his life. What was it? Watching the fall of the Berlin Wall in November 1989, holed up in the KGB headquarters, Putin, then 37, grew panicked as he watched crowds march on the headquarters of Stasi, the East German secret police, and then begin to gather outside the KGB's villa. As his colleagues frantically burned documents, Putin made a desperate call to the Soviet military command for help. To his profound shock, none was forthcoming. I got the feeling then that the country no longer existed, that it had disappeared. Putin said years later, his feelings of betrayal and humiliation intensified with the subsequent collapse of the Soviet Union. Putin drew several formative lessons from his Dresden experience. It instilled in him a loathing for democratic mobs and a bitter resentment of the West. It taught him, he said last month, that even a momentary paralysis of power is the first step toward complete degradation and oblivion. And it implanted in him a driving obsession that lies behind his stunning aggression in Ukraine. What is this obsession? To avenge Russia and restore its lost glory? In his mind, Mr. Putin finds himself in a unique historical situation in which he can finally recover for the previous years of humiliation, said Russian journalist Mikhail Zeiger. Russia's return to superpower status, Putin has said, starts with his total control over a super-centralized state. The next phase is reassembling a Russian-speaking empire within the former Soviet Union's borders. To see Ukrainians building a Western-style democracy within those old borders is a mortal threat to his imperial ambitions, said Model of Rutgers. Some Putin analysts also point to a religious dimension to Putin's vision. What role does religion play? Putin has embraced the Russian Orthodox Church as a core element of nationalistic Russian identity. He wears a baptismal cross and is shown in state media engaging in religious rites. The church's leaders share his vision not only of a morally decaying West, but of restoring a Svyataya Rus, Holy Russia, that extends to Russian Orthodox believers in former Soviet republics. As the site of the founding of Russian Orthodoxy, Kyiv holds great significance, and church leaders were affronted when in 2019 the Ukrainian Orthodox Church asserted its independence from the Patriarchate of Moscow, whose jurisdiction it has been under for centuries. The nationalistic head of the Russian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Kirill, has formed a close bond with Putin, calling him a miracle from God. The extent to which Putin sees himself as a messianic figure on a spiritual quest to save Russia is underappreciated by many in the West, writes British journalist Giles Fraser. In the face of such a vision, he writes, it's deluded to think that a bunch of sanctions is going to make a blind bit of difference. We'll read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with the tragic red state COVID failure. Republicans are killing us, said Dana Milbank. That's the inescapable conclusion of two new analyses of state-by-state data on COVID deaths since July 1st, when life-saving vaccines became available to all Americans. The 14 states with the highest death rates are all run by Republican governors. West Virginia, with 199 deaths per 100,000, was the worst, with Wyoming, 172, and Florida, 153, second and third worst. In stark contrast, the deep blue District of Columbia had only 27 deaths per 100,000, while California had 58. The statistics are damning. Florida residents were nearly seven times as likely to die from COVID-19 as residents of D.C., nearly three times as likely to die as residents of California, and two and a half times as likely to die as residents of New York. Given that Florida has 22 million people, that's thousands of unnecessary deaths. Why the huge disparity between red states and blue? Disinformation. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has chosen to reinforce false fears about the vaccine safety and to threaten and sue schools and private businesses that had vaccine and mask mandates. It all leads you to wonder, how does Ron DeSantis sleep at night? When guns come to church. On a recent Sunday, a man clad in olive green entered my church in Alabama with a semi-automatic handgun on his hip, said Lanier Scott Isom. Can I sit here? He whispered, moving into an empty space in my pew. I eyed his gun with rising panic. I can't tell if he is military or paramilitary, a proud boy or a plainclothes cop. Is he going to murder us all? Alabama is an open carry state, and anyone can enter a house of worship or other public place visibly armed without even getting a permit for the weapon. In 2015, a man entered a church in East Selma, Alabama, with a gun and shot his girlfriend and her son. In 2017, a gunman killed 26 people and wounded 20 at a church in Sutherland Springs, Texas. So I sat through the service literally sweating, imagining our massacred bodies. The pastor later told me he rushed through the service while thinking he should tell everyone to flee. How do the rest of us know if the stranger with the gun walking into a church or a restaurant is a would-be terrorist? We don't. So we must continue to live in a heightened state of fear. This comes from Europe. The European Union overwhelmed by Ukrainian refugees. Desperate Ukrainians fleeing Russian bombs are surging into neighboring European Union countries in the worst refugee crisis since World War II, said Zasha Wanat in Politico. As Russians relentlessly shell Ukrainian hospitals and apartment blocks, close to 3 million refugees have embarked upon treacherous journeys by train or car or on foot to Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, and Romania. Most are women and children, since Ukraine requires men ages 18 to 60 to stay and fight. In just 2 weeks, Poland alone has let in more than 1.7 million people, and some 100,000 continue to arrive every day. Yet there are no refugee camps. Instead, Poles spontaneously mobilized to help, handing out soup and sandwiches to arrivals, inviting them into their homes, hotels, and restaurants, and giving them clothes and toys. They feel a kinship with Ukrainians, who are culturally and linguistically similar to them. The Nationalist Law and Justice Party, which outright refused to admit Poland's share of the Middle Eastern and African refugees who streamed into the EU in 2015, is now basking in international praise. But critics say it is taking credit for its people's generosity and has done far too little itself to arrange shelter or services. Warsaw and Krakow in particular are buckling under the sheer volume of human beings, said Marcha Kedziski. The government is working on new support mechanisms for refugees and the people who host them, but it doesn't look like the measures will be enough. For now, Poles are listening to their hearts, but their wallets will soon feel the bite. Workers who cannot afford a home loan should not shoulder a responsibility that rightly belongs to the government. To avoid an outbreak of social discontent, we need an organized way to move Ukrainians to less crowded Polish villages, or better yet, to other EU countries. Too bad the UK, which has left the EU, has taken a paltry 1,000, said Fraser Nelson in the Daily Telegraph. While the British government claimed no Ukrainian was being turned away, it sent 300 back to France for lack of paperwork. In a time of unprecedented human need, such bureaucratic pettiness is baffling. But Poland isn't bearing up alone, said Jan Klauth. More than 10,000 refugees are now arriving in Berlin daily. And here, too, citizens are offering their spare rooms. Yet many Ukrainian women and children don't want to be housed with strange men, and human traffickers have already been spotted lurking around the main train station. Volunteers on the scene insist that without clear plans to house and protect the refugees, the situation will descend into chaos. The unprecedented numbers are overwhelming, said Pascal Martin. The EU has, at least, bypassed its normal asylum procedure to give Ukrainians temporary protection. This will allow them to live and work in any EU country for up to 3 years, hopefully enough time for a diplomatic solution that will allow them to return home. If part or all of Ukraine falls, though, we'll have to transform provisional measures into permanent ones. The Last Word, our feature article, titled this week, Could the U.S. Try to Kill Putin? The war in Ukraine has sparked talk of regime change in Moscow, said journalist Stephen Kinzer in Politico. But the history of U.S. efforts to kill heads of state is not encouraging. America's rage at a foreign demon has rarely been as intense as our current fixation on Vladimir Putin. He is this generation's Mao or Castro, its Gaddafi or Saddam or Khomeini, the rampaging and perhaps deranged foreign tyrant who personifies everything we hate and fear. Many in Washington see last month's invasion of Ukraine as entirely his doing. Some believe the world will never be at peace as long as he lives and rules. From there, it's a short step to wishing him sawed off, as Dwight Eisenhower put it, when he ordered Fidel Castro's assassination in 1960. Is there a Brutus in Russia? Is there a more successful Colonel Stauffenberg in the Russian military? Senator Lindsey Graham mused recently. The only way to end this ends is for somebody in Russia to take this guy out. In some circles, it might be considered imprudent for a leading political figure to urge the murder of a foreign leader. Graham, however, was only expressing publicly what some of his colleagues may wish privately. The reasoning is simple. If Putin is the problem, eliminate Putin and the problem disappears. The Fox News host Sean Hannity jumped aboard, reasoning that you cut off the head of the snake and you kill the snake. Right now, the snake is Vladimir Putin. Two deep fallacies undermine this argument. First is the premise itself, that a different Russian leader might seek an accord to withdraw troops from Ukraine. No one who hopes to secure power in Moscow, however, could ever accept Ukraine's entry into NATO or the presence of hostile troops on Ukrainian soil. Any Russian president who did so would be seen as exposing his country to mortal danger and quickly deposed. The second and more illuminating argument against killing foreign leaders is the poor record we have in past attempts. We've tried it repeatedly. Often we have failed, but even when we seem to have succeeded, the long-term consequences have been terrible. An order from the Oval Office to assassinate a foreign leader would not break a taboo. It would only be the latest in a series of self-defeating blunders. So far as is known, Dwight Eisenhower was the first president to order such assassinations. He began by targeting Premier Zhou Enlai of China. During the 1950s, Eisenhower and nearly every other policymaker in Washington considered the Red Chinese to be maniacal fanatics bent on world conquest. When Zhou announced in 1955 that he would travel to Bandung, Indonesia for a momentous conference of Asian and African leaders, the CIA saw a chance to kill him. Zhou chartered an Air India jet for his flight to Bandung. It exploded in midair, killing 16 passengers, but Zhou had not boarded. China called it murder by the special services organizations of the United States. After Zhou landed safely on another flight, CIA Director Alan Dulles decided to try again. He directed the chief of CIA's chemical division, Sidney Gottlieb, to prepare poison. Gottlieb made one that would kill Zhou 48 hours after it was dropped into his rice bowl, presumably after he was back home in China, giving the Americans plausible deniability. The plot was aborted at the last moment when General Lucian Truscott Jr., then serving as a deputy CIA director, learned of it and exploded in anger. Fearing that CIA involvement would become known, according to his biographer, he confronted Dulles and forced him to cancel the operation. Gottlieb destroyed all his files upon leaving the CIA in 1973. As a result, and because of the tradition that assassination orders must never be explicit, no details of the Zhou Enlai plot have been discovered. It was the strict policy of the CIA, however, never to embark on something as serious as assassinating a head of government without presidential approval. Evidence ties Eisenhower more directly to other plots. During the summer of 1960, he was preoccupied by political murders. His main target was the demon who would obsess American leaders for generations and still does today, even though he is dead, Fidel Castro. On May 13, 1960, after receiving a briefing from Dulles, he ordered Castro sawed off. In that period of history, its meaning would have been clear, Richard Bissell, then the CIA's covert action chief, testified years later. Eisenhower was a tough man behind that smile. Eisenhower's order set off a wild series of assassination attempts. For more than 3 years, CIA planners considered plots ranging from a sniper shot to an exploding seashell. The most elaborate ones involved toxins or devices designed by Gottlieb. They included, according to a later Senate report, poison pills, poison pens, deadly bacterial powders, and other devices which strain the imagination. While waiting for news of success in his plot against Castro, which never came, Eisenhower ordered another assassination. His victim was to be Patrice Lumumba, a defiant nationalist who was elected prime minister of the Congo in May 1960. Eisenhower feared Lumumba's challenge to Western power in a huge African country that controlled vast mineral riches. On the morning of August 18, 1960, Dulles received an electrifying cable from the CIA station chief in Congo, Larry Devlin. Embassy and station believe Congo experiencing classic communist effort takeover government, it said. Anti-West forces rapidly increasing power in Congo, and therefore may be little time left in which to take action to avoid another Cuba. Dulles took the cable to the Oval Office. From 11:10 to 11:23 that morning, according to Eisenhower's official calendar, he held an off-the-record meeting with Dulles and other CIA officers. After hearing their report, the note-taker wrote, the president turned to Dulles and said something to the effect that Lumumba should be eliminated. There was stunned silence for about 15 seconds, and the meeting continued. Senate investigators later pinpointed this moment as the point when Eisenhower circumlocutiously ordered Lumumba's assassination. A couple of weeks later, Devlin received a cable from CIA headquarters telling him to expect a visit from an officer who would identify himself as Joe from Paris. When the officer arrived, Devlin recognized him as Sidney Gottlieb, the CIA's poison maker. Gottlieb handed him a packet containing a vial of liquid botulinum and told him he was to use it to kill Lumumba. Jesus H. Christ, Devlin cried. Who authorized this operation? President Eisenhower, Gottlieb told him. I wasn't there when he approved it, but Dick Bissell said that Eisenhower wanted Lumumba removed. Then he helpfully added, with the stuff that's in here, no one will ever be able to know that Lumumba was assassinated. Devlin managed to organize a coup in which Lumumba was overthrown, but not killed. He remained immensely popular both at home and abroad. Devlin's efforts to penetrate his security ring and poison him, including an attempt to slip him a tube of tainted toothpaste, all failed. At one point, Devlin and his officers considered using a commando-type group to capture him. Then they asked if a sharpshooter with a high-powered foreign-made rifle could be found. On November 27th, Lumumba slipped out of the home where he was being held under Congolese and United Nations guard. Devlin set out to find and capture him. His key partners were intelligence officers from Belgium, the former colonial power, which had become fabulously wealthy by exploiting the Congo's mineral wealth. Together, they had Lumumba tracked, seized, tortured, and delivered to his most murderous local enemies. A Congolese squad executed him under the watchful Belgian eyes. No American was president. Years later, an interviewer asked Dulles if he regretted any of his operations. I think that we overrated the danger in, let's say, the Congo, he replied. Devlin agreed. When Eisenhower left office in January 1961, he could count one successful assassination, Lumumba, in concert with the Belgians, and two failures, Zhao Enlai and Castro. His successor, John F. Kennedy, focused intently on Castro. There was a flat-out effort ordered by the White House, the president, Bobby Kennedy, who after all was his right-hand man, to unseat the Castro government, to do everything possible to get rid of it by whatever device could be found, former CIA Director Richard Helms later told congressional investigators. The Kennedy administration sought relentlessly to kill Castro, even as it sent peace feelers to him through secret channels. On the very day President Kennedy was assassinated, a CIA officer in Paris passed a poison device to an operative who was to use it to kill Castro. Kennedy also embraced another of Eisenhower's Caribbean plots, aimed at the Dominican dictator Rafael Trujillo. Both presidents detested Trujillo and feared that his brutal rule might produce a Castro-style revolution. In July 1960, while Eisenhower was in office, the CIA delivered 12 sterile rifles with telescopic sights to anti-Trujillo plotters. 9 months later, with Kennedy in the White House, it delivered 3 carbines. The plotters carried out their tyrannicide on May 30, 1961. Democracy emerged a couple of years later, but the United States decided it could not tolerate that democracy because President Juan Bosch seemed too leftist and sympathetic to Castro. That led the United States to launch its 1965 invasion of the Dominican Republic and to stage manage the election of a former Trujillo ally, Joaquin Balaguer, who went on to dominate the country for much of the next 30 years. The assassination that most tormented Kennedy was the one he set in motion but did not realize he had ordered. In a jumble of diplomatic missteps and without a direct presidential command, the Kennedy administration authorized the overthrow of South Vietnamese President Ngo Dinh Diem. On November 1, 1963, assured of U.S. support, plotters carried out their coup and then assassinated Diem. Kennedy leaped to his feet and rushed from the room with a look of shock and dismay on his face, which I had never seen before. General Maxwell Taylor, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, later wrote of the moment when the news of Diem's death landed in the Oval Office. He had always insisted Diem must never suffer more than exile and had been led to believe or had persuaded himself that a change in government could be carried out without bloodshed. Kennedy's successor, Lyndon Johnson, embraced covert action, as have all modern American presidents, but did not emulate his two predecessors by authorizing assassination. The day after Kennedy was killed, he showed a visitor a portrait of Diem and said, "We had a hand in murdering him. Now it's happening here." Later, Johnson wondered if Kennedy's assassination was divine retribution. He also expressed disgust for the plots against Castro and Trujillo. "We were running a GD Murder Incorporated in the Caribbean." Americans are by nature. That makes killing a foreign leader seem like a good way to end a war. Every time we have tried it, though, we've failed, whether or not the target falls. Morality and legality aside, it doesn't work. Castro thrived on his ability to survive American plots. In the Congo, almost everything that has happened since Lumumba's murder has been awful. Our record in carrying out regime change, short of murder, is hardly better. The CIA-directed overthrow of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953 cast Iran into a political whirlwind from which it still has not escaped. A year later, the CIA coup against President Jacobo Arbenz of Guatemala aborted a 10-year democratic experiment and set that country on a path towards civil war and genocide. Soon after the Guatemala coup, Eisenhower invited Dulles and other CIA officers to the White House for official congratulations. They presented an elaborate account of their operation, complete with charts, slides, and film clips. Eisenhower had one question. "Why the hell didn't you catch Arbenz?" he asked. "Mr. President," came the reply, "that would have set a very dangerous precedent for you." Stephen Kinzer is the author of Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. A version of this article was originally published in Politico. We have a couple of health and science pieces, starting with, was Stonehenge a calendar? It has long been thought that Stonehenge in southwest England was used only to track the winter and summer solstices, not the days and months of the year. But new research indicates that the imposing prehistoric monument may have also served as a solar calendar, reports the Times. The stone circle erected over the course of 1,500 years is composed of two types of rock, bluestone monoliths from Wales and larger sandstone slabs known as sarsens from a quarry much closer. The site was ringed by 30 upright sarsens, of which only 17 remain, supporting 30 horizontal lintels. The study says that each of these represented one day of the month to make 360 days total, and that another five arches in the center of the circle made up the final days of the year. The theory is that the Britons who started building Stonehenge in the 3rd millennium BC could have been inspired by a type of calendar used in Egypt and Mesopotamia around that time, when populations were migrating significantly. Lead author Timothy Darville of Bournemouth University says his study is the first that makes sense in terms of using the stones that are there contemporaneously. Amazon could disappear. The Amazon rainforest is approaching a crucial tipping point that could see it permanently transformed into a grassy savanna, new data suggests. Home to a vast and unique array of plant and animal life, the dense tropical forest also acts as a massive carbon sink because its trees evaporate significant amounts of water into the atmosphere. Its loss could affect global weather patterns. Scientists who have examined satellite data from the past 20 years have concluded that about three-quarters of the rainforest is displaying signs of resilience loss, meaning it is less able to recover from things like droughts, logging, and forest fires. The decline was most stark in areas that were nearer human activity and received less rainfall. The researchers say it's impossible to tell when the irreversible transition from rainforest to savanna might happen, reports CNN.com. But they say that by the time the process is observable, it will be impossible to stop. My hunch, says co-author Timothy M. Linton from the University of Exeter in the UK, is that it could happen in the space of decades. We're on the Talking Points page. Start with an article, Russia. Will its propaganda bubble break? Today's Russia is to some degree a fantasy land, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times. Since the invasion of Ukraine, authorities have shut down most independent news outlets, threatened both Russian and Russia-based Western journalists with up to 15 years imprisonment for accurately reporting its brutal invasion of Ukraine, and ensured that TV news programs churn out pro-Kremlin propaganda. Starved of accurate information, Russians gorge on disinformation, including that Ukraine's leaders are Nazis, and the U.S. is funding bioweapons labs in Ukraine. Even the many Ukrainians with family in Russia can't pierce the bubble. When they called to describe the bloodshed and destruction they're witnessing, their Russian relatives reply that it can't be happening and that Vladimir Putin's special military operation aims only to denazify Ukraine. They believe everything is calm in Kyiv, said Valentina Kremer of her siblings in Russia. It is impossible to convince them. Not all Russians are deluded, said Tim Swarens in USA Today. Marina Oskinokova, an editor for the government-controlled TV channel Russian Channel 1, shocked viewers this week when she ran onto the set of its nightly newscast shouting, "Stop the war," and carrying a sign saying, "Don't believe the propaganda. They're lying to you." She was immediately fired and arrested, but she isn't the first to reject Putin's narrative. An estimated 13,000 plus Russians have been arrested at street protest. There's yet more evidence that the Kremlin's narrative is falling flat online, said Ian Garner in Foreign Policy. Though Russia now blocks Western social media outlets such as Facebook and Instagram, the chat site Telegram, where anti-government information spreads unimpeded, has about 38 million Russian users. But to seek the truth beyond Russia's growing digital Iron Curtain, Russians have to be tech-savvy and persistent, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Most Russians still rely on TV and government-approved websites for their news, sources of comforting myths about their nation's greatness and righteousness. Sound familiar? Said Matt Lewis in the Daily Beast. Tens of millions of Americans who rely on Fox News, Facebook, and right-wing websites have embraced conspiracy theories claiming that Donald Trump won the 2020 election and that Democrats operate a vast pedophile ring. In Russia, Putin has shut down the alternatives to his propaganda. What's our excuse? 2020 census, undercounting people of color. Donald Trump's stolen election narrative may be his most notorious attempt to subvert democracy, said Jihad Jones in MSNBC.com. But it was far from the only one. His administration worked hard to discourage people, particularly non-white people, from reporting to the census. And last week, the Census Bureau revealed that the 2020 survey miscounted nearly 19 million people. That included an overcount of white Americans and an undercount of black, Hispanic, and Native Americans. These errors were considerably worse than in previous censuses, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Nearly 5% of American Hispanics, for example, were missed. And the Trump administration deserves the lion's share of the blame. It did everything in its power to skew the count away from people of color, shortening the counting period, and publicly announcing it would add a citizenship question to its questionnaire to intimidate Latinos. Although the Supreme Court blocked that cynical ploy, many immigrants were afraid to participate. There was a battery of other problems that were unavoidable, said Dan McLaughlin in National Review. COVID-19 lessened the effectiveness of door-to-door census taking, as many people became afraid to open their door to a stranger and respond to questions. Wildfires in the West and hurricanes on the East and Gulf Coast forced tens of thousands to flee their homes. But in a big, unforced error for Republicans, GOP governors in Florida, Texas, and Arizona did little or nothing to promote the census, while blue states invested heavily in getting people counted. As a result, the counted population growth in red states fell short of expectations, so fewer House seats shifted there. Don't expect a recount, though. It would face formidable political obstacles, cost billions, and might be deemed unconstitutional. So where do we go from here, asked G. Christina Mora and Julie Dowling in the Los Angeles Times. The legislative maps that relied on faulty data can't be undone. But the Census Bureau's recent corrections could help ensure that more of the $1.5 trillion in federal funds for public services is distributed to where people really are. For 2030, we should consider rephrasing the race and ethnicity questions to clear up any ambiguity for Middle Easterners and Hispanics of mixed ancestry, as well as creating new rules to shore up the Bureau's political independence. The decennial count must never again be held hostage to presidential whims. Here's some shorter notes. Due largely to understaffing and lack of funding, some 17% of the 2 million phone calls to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline last year were abandoned before the caller connected to a counselor. 41% of texts went unanswered. Suicides have risen over the past two decades to about 45,000 a year. In the opening month of the pandemic, roughly 9 in 10 Americans said they trusted the CDC. 2 years later, that number had dropped to 16% for those who said they got most of their news from Fox or other conservative outlets. The agency was still trusted by 77% of those who primarily watch network news and read newspapers, and 87% of those who rely on CNN or MSNBC. Public school districts in Arkansas that required masks had 23% lower rates of COVID among students and staff members than districts without mandates, according to a CDC study. The study looked at 233 districts in 2021 when the Delta variant was spreading. A new amendment to anti-abortion legislation in Missouri would allow citizens to sue any state resident for helping a woman travel out of state to undergo the procedure. Since Missouri restricted abortion in 2019, thousands of women have gone to Illinois for abortions, including 10,644 at a single Planned Parenthood just across the border. On the poll watch, 62% of Americans oppose laws that ban lessons in elementary school about sexual orientation or gender identity. 37% support such legislation, including 61% of Republicans and 35% of independents. We've got time to read two of the quotes today. The first comes from activist Frances Lear, quoted in the Washington Post, who says, "I believe the second half of one's life is meant to be better than the first half. The first half is finding out how you do it, and the second half is enjoying it." And the second quote comes from James Baldwin, quoted in the New York Straits Times from Malaysia. Appropriate for a bunch of readers out there. "You think your pain and your heartbreak are unprecedented in the history of the world, but then you read." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have any questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.